The Nordic countries did very well during the modern era. Their secret? An approach to education called Bildung. Metamodernity is a possible future where we take the best from the past and the present, locally and globally, and turn it into a meaningful future for all. My name is Lena Rachel Andersen. Welcome to Nordic Metamodern. This is the second episode, and we are going to explore metamodernity or metamodernism. What is it? And to have that conversation, I have invited two guests, Robin van den Akker from the Netherlands and Rune Rasmussen from Denmark. And they have a very, in some respect, overlapping academic background, but they also come from two different angles in academia when we're going to talk about this big picture of history and modernity and where we're heading and where we are in history. But before we get into the details, I would like the two of them to just introduce themselves, and then we will hear about their academic background, and then we'll get into a discussion about, so what is metamodernity? And Robin, if you would start, please.
Yes, thank you, Lena. Well, my name is Robin. I'm a philosopher of culture working at Erasmus University Rotterdam. There I am leading a research and innovation center, among other things. And for a couple of years now, we have been discussing among colleagues the notion of metamodernism as a marker in time after the period of postmodernism. And for me, the ism is an important variation on the metamodernity that we will also discuss, I think, today.
Thank you. Rune, please.
Thank you, Lene. I'm an anthropologist of religion, and presently I'm an academic maverick who is shouting on the YouTube, a little bit like, is it Josiah in the Bible who's shouting in the desert? My main background is working on counter-modernity among Afro-diasporic peoples, but I've sort of taken that into looking at our own majority Eurodescendant cultures, and I'm in doing that, I'm inspired by how indigenous peoples today are looking at their own cultures. So what I'm basically doing is I'm sort of working with the idea actually of traditionalism as something that is dynamic and that we can use to renew ourselves into this age that we live in today, in different kinds of dialogues with the past, and that this is something that we can use for instance, creating kinds of culture that are less cataclysmically, apocalyptically gargantuanly destructive to the world that we live in. So yeah, that's what I do.
Wonderful, thank you. So this is a bit of this episode is going to be a bit different because I have a little bit of my own, or quite a lot actually, of my own work at stake in this conversation. Usually I will be inviting guests in to discuss their topic or their professional topic, but I read about metamodernity, so I will also do one of the short presentations. So maybe, Robin, you can introduce us to metamodernism, the way that you have been looking at it and working at it.
Yes, absolutely. So for us, metamodernism is a moment in culture that emerged in the 2000s. We see the 2000s as a period and not so much as a decade. And in that period, the metamodern structure of feeling emerged. We use the notion of structure of feeling to determine and designate the fact that it is sort of phenomenologically an affect, a feeling that is widely shared and has structural aspects that can be recognized in, we use the arts as a privileged way into this structure of feeling, but you can also look at popular culture or other phenomena, of course. We have been using the arts. For us, it emerged in the 2000s and became dominant in the 2010s. Now with recent world historical events like the pandemic and now the geopolitical effects of the war in the Ukraine. that is all very recent, so I don't want to fall into the pitfall of recency bias. But I think it's important to highlight these more recent events as sort of accelerators of this becoming of the metamodern structure of feeling. Yes, so it's a widely shared sentiment, sensibility, you could say, but it's also a feeling that structures. So it structures the way we do, the way we think, the way we position ourselves in time. So it has all kinds of other effects in cultural forms and practices. So for us, this is a dominant. That's why I like to use the word metamodernism and not metamodernity, which would be a sort of more or less coherent and unified system, perhaps. But for us, it's a dominant form in culture, which means that it's not a sort of a all encompassing phenomena, but that it is widely present. But there are, of course, also more marginal or residual cultural forms present as well in culture. What is interesting for us is that the relation to these other residual or future or emergent structure of feelings and cultural forms is different than it was under postmodernism. So we see a different relationship to the past and the future as well in the current day and age than, let's say, in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, or the 80s, the 90s. So that is maybe also a topic that that Rune and I can discuss, considering you are also interested in this differential relation to the past and to the non-global north as well. So that's for me already a very interesting way into this conversation.
And maybe we should, for those who are completely new to the whole metamodern ism or the ity or whatever we're discussing here, it is very much the modern and the postmodern that is brought together. Or I mean, we've been through previous isms. We had a modernism in the art. We've had a postmodernism in the art. I mean, what are the, can you just say a little bit more about the relationship to those two or other isms before we let Rune explore what he does?
Well, first of all, it is a marker in time for a cultural moment. You can also talk about art forms. But as a marker in time, it indicates that we have a different relationship to the past and the future in the present. And it also goes for a different relationship to the postmodern moment and to the modern moment. You see that was one of our analyses. You see a different relationship to modernism or to, in our first essay, to romanticism, for instance, than in the postmodern years. And that has as a reason that younger generations are desperately trying to look for forms and for languages and for practices that enable them to move into a future, how and what that future will look like. That is unsure. So they're rummaging, as it were, through the dustbin of history. And that includes as well modern forms that are incorporated into contemporary forms, romantic, but all kinds of past forms.
So it draws on a lot of heritage, but also contemporary, I guess, confusion.
Yes.
Rune, you're talking about animism. I mean, you go really far back, but also, as you said, there are some contemporary examples of this. So what is it that you do with regards to these?
Yeah, with regards specifically to animism, that people would tend to project that very far back and say that's something that belongs in the hunter-gatherer societies of the Stone Age, something like that. But I don't see animism, and I think most contemporary scholars of, for instance, new animism and ontological turn and these things would see animism as something that has both relevance and presence in much broader contexts than that. And I think that with animisms is basically about relationships, and what is I think that an important aspect of how I think this, particularly in relation to all the different metamodernities and postmodernities and all that, is that I think it very much in relation to modernity. And in my way of looking at that, I define modernity epistemologically as that sometimes called the Cartesian splits, where inside human minds there are meaning and subjectivity and songs and angels and all that, all the cool stuff, and out there is a dead machine-like world. And modernity has that trend in it of building up that way of perceiving the world. It sometimes be called the separatist agenda of deanimating bodies and disembodying minds. So the basic sort of assumption that I'm working on is the idea that if we want the world to be dead, then the world bloody well dies of it, and that is part of the big problem basically with modernity, that the idea of the dead world seems to be producing a dead world. And as you're probably aware, since the time that most of us were born and until today, half the world's vertebrate species has gone extinct, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The cataclysms are overwhelming. So one part of trying to build perceptions in a world that is heading for the biggest cataclysm in the history of life for 66 million years is to think with relationalism and think that the idea of the dead world, or the idea of the living world and the idea of engaging the world as living, perhaps has a potential to also maintain the world as living. So that's sort of the thinking background to what I do. So I'm and since I'm living in Northern Europe, I'm then communicating animism under the sort of the label Nordic animism, because we live in Northern Europe. But in fact, this idea of thinking about, for instance, majority populations as people who have an animist heritage, that could apply to any place in the world. There is this weird idea, both I think in our culture, but also in scholarship, that this respect-based way of building relation with the living world is only something that you have if you are a marginalized indigenous ethnicity that has been oppressed by a perhaps expansive colonized state. And this idea is like, I mean, even from sort of the surface of it, it's totally incorrect, and yet it's really widely spread, which I think is part of, I think actually it's part of the construction, both of modernity, but also of whiteness, things that are, of course, connected. The idea that we are not Ooga Boogas, that is the others, that are the others, and they are the ones that we are, of course, supposed to come and give bless with our benevolent civilization. So that also means that and these are sort of the foundations, I think, that the idea of even thinking stuff like Euro-descendant animism is not basically on the table anywhere, and that is also why it's difficult to introduce it. When you're introducing this kind of stuff, it will immediately be labeled as sort of silly New Age stuff, or national romanticist reveries, or even fascism, and this particular brand of kind of branding is, of course, part of keeping Euro descendants or Euro majorities in isolations from being in active negotiation with these parts of our cultural heritage, in order to perhaps try to reproduce something that's less destructive for the future. Well, I think, did I get into preaching there? I think I did. I think I did. Anyway,
that was great. I mean, you converted me to animism there, and
awesome.
So I'll take more than that, though. But thank you, Rune. So my entry point into this whole metamodernism and metamodernity thing comes from futurism. I've been writing books about the future since 2005, and very much out of a worry about what's going to happen with artificial intelligence, what's going to happen with globalization, how are we going to create democratic structures that can create the new institutions that we need for new technologies, what is happening when we are approaching 8 billion people on the globe, can we produce food for everybody, and how do we create, you know, maintain global stability and stuff, and not just global stability, but actually equality around the globe. And there are so many huge issues, and then there's climate, and there's extinction of species, all these real, you know, out there in the dead world, so to speak, problems. And in order for us to grasp this, we need to have the inner world grasping what goes on out there. And for me, the approach to that is, of course, to educate. I mean, we need more knowledge, and we need more kinds of knowledge, and we need to have open venues for people to discuss their worries and their understanding and their questions and all this stuff. So that's my approach to this. And when I first heard about metamodernism, I think it was around 2012, could have been 2014. One of the first sources that I ran into was Robin's work together with Timotheus Vermeulen with metamodernism, and where you, as far as I read it, were focusing very much on the sort of juxtaposition of the modern and the postmodern, and having grown up in a postmodern world, and then, you know, having this ironical distance to everything, and anything is possible, and there's no absolute truth, and there is no absolute value, and everything can be deconstructed. And then suddenly there was the financial crash in 2008, and there were other crises. And then it's like, oops, maybe there is something that actually matters. You can't just deconstruct everything and shrug your shoulders and do, you know, quotation marks around everything. There are things that we need to take seriously. And that resonated deeply with me. And I think we were many who had that feeling and hadn't had one specific word to put on that feeling. And that was the metamodernism. And then as I started exploring this, I realized that, okay, but before the modern world, there was also something, and it is stuff, just a very academic term, stuff, that is still important to us. And we spent 200 or 300,000 years as hunter-gatherers, living in a world that was so different from the experience that we have in our day and age. And so what I came up with, and that is how I define metamodernity, and that's why also why I call it metamodernity and not metamodernism, is that there are four big chunks of history, or at least I group it into four big chunks of history that all provide something that we need to bring with us into the future, and that can actually be a framework for creating a meaningful future that is sustainable, and where we can communicate both with each other and with nature and with our sense of self and where we're coming from. So the first big chunk is what I now call the prehistoric indigenous. And that would be those 200,000 years until the beginning of the Holocene, but also, you know, in many places of the world up to our day and age, when we managed to, from the West and colonialism and also from other civilizations around the globe, eradicate what was left of the indigenous human experience. And so in this indigenous culture, you have very small tribes, maybe up to 200 people on a daily basis, but turns out that there were also bigger societies than that. But definitely societies where people could assembly the full society together in simultaneously. You could read body language and have eye contact with almost everybody rather quickly. And so you could negotiate questions and conflicts there on the spot with the people in question, and everybody could be together. And it's an animistic culture. It's a cyclical, I mean, the life cycles, the circular concept of time, for instance, and I would say intimacy in society is so different from what we know today. And then the second big chunk of history would be the pre-modern traditional, which is the Bronze Age and the Iron Age and the big city-states and some empires, and where our forefathers and mothers developed what we know as religion today, or what we call religion. And so that is where you have 5, 10,000, maybe 100,000 people in the same society. And in order to keep an internal peace, you have to have institutions. And today we know those institutions as religion. I don't think it was a priesthood that came up with stories in order to keep society together. I think it was societies that produced meaningful stories happened to survive, and therefore we know their stories to this very day. And so we have a lot of heritage from this pre-modern traditional era, and then with Gutenberg's printing press, and afterwards we have capitalism and the modern society. And that's where we get science and human rights and equality, and we get rid of the patriarchy, or at least we try to, that was part of the pre-modern traditional. And then at some point in the previous century, we get this deconstruction of all these so-called truths that are either religion and spiritual or religious truth, revelation, and also the scientific truth produced by modern science. And so we have a postmodern world that deconstructs everything and sort of takes everything apart and seizes from the outside. And all of these four chunks of time have produced ways of being human and insights that we need to bring with us into the future. And metamodernity is to combine it in fruitful ways that allow us to have a lush nature, thriving planet, thriving people, and democratic institutions and wealth and prosperity and democracy and all the good stuff. We can also combine it in the wrong way and take all the worst parts, or combine them in the wrong way and get a hypermodernity where we have technology ruling and a hierarchical patriarchy with some kind of clan structure in the top, which we usually call corruption if you have one family ruling a million strong society, for instance. So when I talk about metamodernity, I'm definitely inspired by the metamodernism, but I also, in order to get the full human experience as the foundation for the future we create, drawing on what went before that. And so we're here with these three different perspectives on what it means to be human, human right now, and also past, yeah, present and future. So I open the floor for comments and insights.
Cool. Can I jump in immediately, Lene? Because I'm inspired. So for me, the very fact that we are having this conversation here right now, a conversation about how to reposition ourselves vis-a-vis our histories and our futures. And I say futures as a multiple. Is telling in itself, and I think also your two, the research practices of both of you are in a sense illustrating this, that we are en masse doing this, so repositioning ourselves in time. And for me, this touches upon something that you also mentioned, and that is the grand narratives and the sort of the end of grand narratives that was proclaimed in the postmodern moment. And for me, that stands for larger debates about the end of this or that, as Jameson calls it. That was a structural feeling of the postmodern period, you could say, that things were coming to an end, not as some kind of, in a millennial apocalyptic way, but more in a sort of laissez-faire, celebratory, relativistic way. That's from the Western perspective, the perspective of the global North, everything seemed to be going better and better, hunky-dory, et cetera, et cetera. So fictions like more equal societies, frictionless capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, the sort of the biggest cipher for this feeling was the debate about the end of history in the early 90s. You could say, triggered by Fukuyama's book, The End of History, and The Last Man, and before that, his essay, The End of History. For me, that is, and Jameson writes that somewhere, this is actually not about time at all, this debate. It is about space. And that's one of his more clever dialectical inversions, you could say. And why does he say that? It's about space rather than about time. Because it is a cipher for the ideological sort of mental blockage that people living in the global north predominantly had then. And that blockage was about not being able to look beyond the present, not feeling the urge to look beyond the present, a sort of presentism, Hartog, the French anthropologist calls it. And that was because our space, our environment on the level of our everyday lives felt very comfortable. That was a comfort zone at the end of history, you could say. It got filled up in every nook and cranny by commodities, with rising living standards, the emergence of the consumer society, sort of the mediatization of our phenomenological realm, with more and more entertainment. So that's on the level of our everyday lives. We were living in sort of a comfort zone, and all the inequalities, destruction, war, blood, that was all sort of outsourced from our experience, you could say. On the global level, you see also that capital starts to envelope the globe. And I want to also highlight that we're talking about capitalism as a system as well here, when we talk about the current moments and modernities and future moments in modernity. It is tied up with capitalism. So capital was enveloping the globe. You saw that China was coming into the world market, you had the fall of the Berlin Wall, et cetera, et cetera. So you had this feeling of euphoria, as it were. Well, that feeling of euphoria has, of course, drastically changed for especially the younger generations in the 2000s and the 2010. There is the absolute existential threat of the ecological crisis, climate crisis, that really hit home hard with the younger generations. I think it's not a coincidence that in the 2000s you also see the emergence of this, and also in terms of frequency of use, the word of Anthropocene and the debates, what should we call it, the Capitalocene? I think so, but let's take Anthropocene as sort of the part of the cultural conversation, as it were. After the financial crisis, bad debts also became a problem for the global north after various years in which it was mostly a problem for the global south, as it were. So financial crises and sort of the unveiling of the rising inequality between classes and generations also hit home hard by then. So this comfort zone got massively disrupted by the system world that sort of ripped open that phenomenological realm that felt so comfortable, but all of a sudden young people experienced firsthand inequality, climate crisis, precarity, debt, and so they realized the system is actually not at all a comfortable system. We are now reproducing in the global north things that we have been outsourcing for decades and generations. So this cluster of crises is for me one of the defining things of the structural feeling, which we call the sense of a bend. The younger generations, and more widely, I think it's a dominant structural feeling, as I said. In culture and society, we have an understanding now that history, again, is bending, not in a straight line. We're not modernists anymore. Yeah? So it's not a theological narrative, but history is on the go again. And the bend also stands for that, yes, we know that we are heading towards catastrophic moment, but it's still hidden around the bend, as it were. We still can only vaguely see its contours. We know that it has to do with inequality. We know that it has to do with planetary destruction, but what it will mean in 20, 30 years is very hard to fathom. So the cluster fuck of world historical proportions is there. It is a cluster. We know we're fucked. It's world historical because we need to address it. Society needs to change. We cannot go on in the current capitalist manner. It needs to be adapted or radically changed. And that is the feeling that we all share. And what you describe, your own practices as researchers, scholars, activists, educators, is finding ways to engage with this moment and this structural feeling, either by rummaging through the dustbin of history, as it were, to find little gems that can help us engaging with this future and orientating ourselves again in the future. So I think this is very revealing for where culture is at the moment, this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just add one thing to your ideas there, or the stuff you're saying, and that is the detachment from the past, which I would say has to do with modernity as something that's constructed in opposition to the traditional as kind of the defining other. And there is a detachment from the past in that very kind of in the root of the very construction of the modern. I totally think that these, or I see this as a problem, for instance, in when contemporary eco-activists from, say, majority populations, when they are trying to address the ecological apocalypse talk about sustainability and these things, then they do not have a past to speak with. They only speak in an apocalyptic present and an even more apocalyptic future. And this is actually what is different. If you look, for instance, at indigenous eco-activists, they do have a past to speak with. And I think that humans need pasts in order to project their future. I think it's one of the most fundamental aspects of how we navigate the world. One example that this is one specific past narrative that I've been sort of trying to introduce a little bit is the idea in pre-Christian mythology that there is a rupture of connectedness in the whole world. When everything becomes detached, then everything kind of descends into this cosmic collapse called the Ragnarok. And that this is basically this idea of an apocalypse has emerged in the 11th century Norway, probably in situations of social rupture, and it reflects on probably the experience of climate change, rather radical and destructive climate change in northern Europe in the 6th century.
And I mean, was this Fimbul winter. I mean, there was really a change in the weather that was radical over several years, and harvests were failing and stuff. I mean,
and which decimated societies all over northern Europe. I mean, we're talking about in some areas of Norway became completely depopulated, or a 70 to 90% population decrease. I mean, we're talking about a fairly cataclysmic event from the social side of things. And so this is just to say, we actually have in our cultural heritage stories that talk about the effects of multiple ruptures, because that is really what this myth is about. It's talking about a broken relationship. Anyway, I guess I'm preaching again now here. This is just an example of like an attempt to address the detachment from past, and with the form of, and I'm almost afraid of using the word traditionalism, because it has such weird connotations, perhaps because we are essentially modern somehow, and when we still think of traditionalism as something that is about playing violins and stomping in the floor with clogs and stuff like that, you know, rather than as I don't know, queer Inuit activism, just to mention, you know, one example of people who could identify as critical of modernity today.
So I would like to pick up on that, because I mean, first of all, what's wrong with clogs and violins? I mean, that's
Nothing at all. It's just a little bit of a stereotype image of of something that is in the past and anachronistic.
Right, but I mean, maybe there's a structural anachronism that is the meta modernity. I would like to pick up on one thing you said with modernism or modernity sort of distancing itself from what went before it. The big chunks of history that I mentioned before, they're all, one of the qualities about them, or one of the characteristics about them, is that whenever we have changed this, I mean, this is also really a definition of morality. Each of these four major periods, and I know that you are not so happy about me just squeezing so much stuff into just four boxes. So we'll have that discussion in a moment. But for each of these big chunks of history and modes of being in the world, the prehistoric, the pre-modern, the modern, and the postmodern, each of those worldviews has looked at the previous one as primitive and sort of tried to distance itself from it because, oh, that was the old way of doing things and that does not suffice anymore. And these were just, you know, old wives' tales or traditionalisms with violence and clogs, for instance. Whereas if you come from, or you look at it from the perspective of the older and smaller community society, they have a hard time seeing that the newer, bigger, more complex cultural code or box of stuff actually does have moral values, but it doesn't have the language and the symbols and the understanding that allows it to grasp it. And so we do have a cultural clash whenever we have these big shifts in cultural code between the modernities or whatever we're going to call them. And we generally do have cultural clashes between societies and groups of people when it's a moral clash. So, I mean, this actually has consequences in the real world. It's not just, you know, interesting stuff for academics like ourselves. We're like, oh, how interesting that culture has changed over the course of history. It actually has consequences when we meet people. So I think that's an important aspect of this. And I also hear what you're saying with the Nordics. I mean, we have, because of the colonialism and because we've had a really bad, you know, historical epoch of using the Norse mythology in serving Nazism or fascism. I mean, it can be hard to bring this kind of tradition out into the open again. So we all come with heritage. These are complex matters, and they touch some really deep and emotional, you know, layers in ourselves, because once we talk about morality, that is really how you make meaning in the world and how you orientate yourself towards world and other people. So we're down to the stuff that really matters here. And just one more thing, when we talk about the Fimbulwinter and how mythology has roots in the weather and how the world has changed, there is reason to believe that the myth that we know in the Judeo-Christian world about Noah and the flood is actually rooted in the beginning of the Holocene era, that is the climate that we've had for 11,000 years, and which has, you know, allowed us to develop modern agriculture or traditional agriculture, and which allows us to feed everybody on the planet right now. Before that, there was an ice age, and a lot of snow and ice melted, and there was a heavy rain period. And it may have been just over the course of 50 years that we got the climate that has brought forth everything that we know today. And before that, there was a different world. It was colder, it was drier, and a lot of people lived in coastal areas. And once it started raining and the ice and the mountains and the northern, you know, south and north pole melted, a lot of people drowned, and we still have stories about that. So So yes, I mean, the culture, the connection to nature and to the climate, it's part of being human and it's all there.
Is now the time where I come with a little bit of my criticism towards your way of thinking? Because, like, yeah, we've spoken about it before, Lena, and mm-hmm. and you sort of
that's
know,
why I invited you.
Yes, it's so now I'm giving it to you. Mm-hmm. I think that the way that you group all of history in these boxes is creating. I think it's creating ways of seeing stuff that's not necessarily particularly precise. I don't think mm-hmm. that older periods looked at the previous ones as primitive. That's a very particularly modern thing. Tradition, the people in the period that you call traditional didn't look at the people before them as being primitive. And often in history, people have looked at previous periods as something that was perhaps ideal or something like that. So that's... I'm sorry, but no, the myth of Noah. I actually think that the Ragnarok myth is a little bit of an exception because it actually talks about climate and weather. The myth of a deluge is found among hunter populations in North America and stuff like that. I think it's a little bit dangerous it's always dangerous when we are painting with a broad with broad strokes like that, and I think that I don't think you can find any anthropologist who will say that there was something called animism in time, which then developed into religion, which was a different thing, and stuff like patriarchy. You know, it will be connected in extremely different ways, in extremely variable ways. There isn't any law that says that it becomes enforced into the traditional. In fact, I think in Europe, patriarchy became enforced transitioning from feudal order and into capitalism, at least according to Silvia Federici, the scholar who studied witch hunts as part of making that depriving women basically of ownership and these kind of things. I just think that like, for instance, with regards to when I talk about traditionalism and animism as ways of looking at the past, I think that the boxing risks making it too not dynamic. Animism has to necessarily be something that, you know, happens between Stone Age hunters. It's not something that happens in, I don't know, TikTok videos, you know, and so on and so forth. And I think that we need to be able to read stuff like, say, animism in TikTok videos to in order to be able to really engage with the past.
I'm very happy to, you know, have this, you know, criticism, and I really appreciate it. And of course, I mean, by squeezing, 11,000 years or 15,000 years into three boxes or 300,000 years into four boxes, of course, does not make sense because you have people in many different places over the course of many, you know, different also natural disasters that have decimated populations and they had to start from scratch. Or, I mean, it's not linear in that respect. And also, I do not definitely not assume that there is a natural order of things. Shit happens, and shit has happened throughout history. And there has been wrong decisions and good decisions. And my main point with this is also that we need to make decisions. There is nothing inevitable about neither a metamodernism or a metamodernity or a hypermodernity or anything. I mean, our decisions shape the future. And it was the same 11,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago or, you know, 500 years ago. So absolutely. What I hope to be able to bring with this model, nevertheless, is a way of navigating through history for those of us who are not historians and who do not have all the details. So it's the really extremely broad, stroke with the historical brush, so that we can navigate. And one of the things that I mean, we've discussed this, is that we have a generation of particularly young people who learn history in, you know, these flashes of events. So they, I mean, in school, they may have had like 2 weeks about the American Revolution, and then a week about the ancient Rome, and then 2 weeks about hunter-gatherers, and then a week about the Vikings or something like that. And when you do not see history as something that unfolds through time, be it chaotic or otherwise, it's really hard to have a sense of, so what is actually, what has evolved? What has made changes? What were the consequences, and what had to be there before the next thing could, you know, was an option? And it also has a very postmodern effect, because if you only have these sort of flashes, moments in time, what can you actually analyze? Well, you can analyze the power structures. So you, all you see in history is different power structures and power struggles in that moment, rather than seeing, okay, so we had the Bronze Age and they created all this stuff, and they, these boats and ships and this kind of navigation and these tools. And then came somebody who, you know, dealt with iron, and suddenly they could do something else. And then it could, by the way, kill somebody who did not have iron. So if we don't see the connections through history, it's really hard to navigate, and also in our own time.
I have stuff to say to that, but I think it's Robin's turn.
Oh, we do turns now. Wonderful. Yes, I think it's there's always a danger in sort of periodizing. I completely acknowledge that. But it's also something that you do to make sense of where we are in time, in order to have a conversation about what is not so much good or bad in a moral sense, but what are the problematic aspects of our day and age that we need to take into account in order to make decisions and develop practices that are, yeah, in our case, more sustainable and progressive. Part of that is doing so by way of narratives, partly. And that is interesting for me about the current day and age. And I'm only an expert in modernity and late modernity, as I call it. And indeed, modernity is this sort of disdain for the past, for tradition, for its, this radical sort of break that it presupposes. And now we are future-oriented people, as it were. So the relation to time and the positioning in history is very much future-orientated, you could say. In the postmodern moment, for me, that is Hartog's argument. It's presentism. So it's constantly the here and now, and the sort of the satisfaction and gratification of you yourself as a subject that is the, sort of the dominant cultural tone. And what is interesting, and you also get the end of the grand narrative there, for instance, so the grand narrative that sketches history in this sort of forward going motion with endpoints and et cetera. There you have the end of the grand narrative, and what we are seeing currently now in culture, I would say, and again, I think both of your practices are just great illustrations of that, is looking for what Donna Haraway calls the big enough story. And the big enough story, it's not a grand narrative. It's not no narrative, but it's just big enough to give sense and meaning to our decisions and our practices. And you see big enough stories everywhere and nowhere at this particular moment. And indeed, big enough stories that take into account indigenous knowledges, past practices, et cetera, but they all want this forward momentum. It's not always generating forward momentum. I think we also have to acknowledge that this tendency of creating big enough stories easily can turn into, again, sort of this grand narratives, can also easily be kidnapped by fascist forces that are currently also at play in society. But it is our duty, and I don't know who I address with our, but at least I see it as part of my duty, let's do it like that, to enforce, stimulate, enable also the sharing of narratives that are progressive and are addressing inequality, the destruction of the planet by the capitalist system. And what I find interesting is indeed the sort of the queer narratives, the indigenous knowledges. That is where we need to also look for inspiration and practices and examples. It's for me it's interesting to hear about, because as I understand you well, Rune, you consider sort of Nordic traditional knowledges. I don't know whether that's still the right name in this context of the conversation. The Nordic traditional knowledges also as indigenous knowledges.
Yes, I don't use the word indigenous for political reasons.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
As a Eurodescendant, we shouldn't undermine the empowerment struggles of indigenous people by appropriating it, or by taking that. And it also risks leaning us towards problematic political positions. So I've chosen to focus on the word traditional. And then I think it's a very intersectional struggle to work with Euro-traditional. That also implies actually addressing some of the very problematic aspects of Euro-traditional, Euro-traditionalism. So that word has been associated with. And by the way, let me just mention one thing about that. Like you mentioned the queer, I'm also super fascinated by Donna Haraway, by the way. And I think that when we are looking at history and the past histories with very contemporary perspectives, such as, for instance, Donna Haraway's queer thinking, like I actually recently made a communication about specifically using Donna Haraway's queer thinking on Nordic mythology, which is an explosion of queer cosmology, actually. You wouldn't think it if you are thinking in stereotype notions of Vikings and all that shit, but it actually is. And I think I just wanted to throw that one on the table. But let me just... If I still have the word, let me just like have a little coin a little reflection on some of the stuff that both of you were just saying there. First, about grand narratives. Maybe because I'm not so read into the stuff that you guys are, I'm not sure I see the problem with a grand narrative in itself. If it's as you say, a grand narrative that has a lot of space for, I don't know, stuff like queer perspectives, progressive thoughts and intentions in the world. But the periodizing that you're talking about, like you explained it, Lene, as based in causation. And last time we spoke, Lene, we spoke about The Dawn of Everything by Graeber and Wengrow, this quite amazing book, and they actually criticize exactly that. They say we have to see evolution because we need to see, you know, as you said it, what had to be there in order for there to be a next thing. And when you, for instance, are equating, say, indigenous peoples with prehistory, then, you know, we might as well flip it, you know, try to imagine, and perhaps a big enough story that talks about Graeber and Wengrow's how they reference to the Cahokia civilization that was in North America 1,000 years ago, but which was apparently rather suddenly rejected, following on which Native Americans started to, it seems, or according to Graeber and Wengrow's narrative, they started to create stuff like republics, parliamentarist systems, and these constitutional processes that came out of it, that which, by the way, was then very much received by Europe in the early Enlightenment period. Now that, and what Graeber also says is that then what they used totemism to create system of coherence that were almost continent wide. It seems that these Americans, at some point approximately 1,000 years ago, suddenly thought states, pharaohs, cities, nah, we don't want to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to disperse, make these slightly more Republican kind of societies, such as the Choctaw and the Chickasaw and the Iroquois, all these peoples. And then they have systems of relating that tie them together across the entire continent. And these systems of the relatings, the totemic relations, they are in fact based on people's connectedness to the world. So if we move away from the idea of the indigenous as the prehistoric, we could say they see us as prehistoric. We are living in Cahokia, and perhaps a choice that is in front of us is we can, and I'm aware now that I'm totally spinning a myth now, if not a grand narrative, but we can think of ourselves at least with as in an analogy with the people in Cahokia. Our nation states have utterly, utterly failed in dealing with the biggest problem in the history of our species. Utterly. Perhaps there are other ways of structuring humanity where very broad, totemic, land-connected based ways of building self-image can form some sort of perhaps international webs of connection. Yeah. And this is, of course, not to romanticize Native Americans. They had wars and all kinds of stuff as well. It's just a suggestion for a perhaps big enough narrative that we can move forward with.
I mean, there are definitely parallel, you know, histories and development of culture and societies, and complexity of society has very much to do with the size of society. How many people do you need to keep together, and how can you do that, and how can you reduce the amount of violence in order for it to work, for instance? And here narrative comes in. So when people share a narrative, they tend to trust each other because they, you know, have the same moral values embedded in that narrative. So, I mean, this has many different layers. And when I started calling it prehistoric indigenous, it was in order to distinguish it from the current indigenous peoples that are still around and who still have lots of indigenous knowledge that is connected to nature and place and climate and flora and fauna where they are. Because they have, of course, also mutated their culture and changed stuff in the meeting with Westerners, with cell phones, with, you know, cars and people coming from the outside, the way that, I mean, there are so few, you know, cultures left that have not had encounters with the modern world. So, I mean, whatever the wording is, my point is that, you know, they did not have cars and cell phones 100,000 years ago, and they did not have democracy with voting booths and a debate with dedicated politicians representing different parties. So there are structures that have come to the human species later because they couldn't have happened earlier. So that is my main point. In order to navigate this and to have some frameworks for understanding, those are the four boxes. So I absolutely appreciate the criticism of it. So I'm really happy that we're having these conversations. It also, I mean, I learned so much. And by the way, the Wengrove and Graeber book is just brilliant. I really love it. So absolutely agree. One of the things, Runa, that we talked about is that when we lose the animism and that spiritual connection to nature, one of the things that might replace it is conspiracy theories. I mean, that there is a space in a room in our cognitive abilities, in our emotional life, in our social life, whatever it is, that needs to be filled with something that has the character of whatever it is animism is. And if we don't have that, we put something else in there. And that might be conspiracy theories. Would you like to say a few words about that? I would also like to hear what Robin thinks of that.
Yeah, I'm in this thinking, I'm kind of inspired by the Aboriginal Australian complexity thinker, Tyson Junker Porter, who wrote this amazing book, Sand Talk. And he is talking about right story. The Indigenous Australians, they actually have culturally rooted practices for finding the right myth, a myth that creates relation in the world in a productive way. That's something I think that we really, really need. What he then became aware of is that there's also wrong story, because in fact, a lot of QAnon conspiracy things were rampantly spreading among Aboriginal Australians and about among Maori in New Zealand also, by the way. So so this thinking emerged partly from these conversations. And the thing is that when animist people, perhaps any human beings, but specifically when animists encounter the world, we encounter the world as an encounter with a someone rather than as an observation of a something. Now that means that the world is imbued with agency and intention in our engagement with it. That means that when, for instance, the smallpox epidemic hit West Africa in the 19th century, what happened immediately wasn't that West Africans sat down and cooked up some ideas about Europeans designing smallpox in laboratories, even though they had actually brought the epidemic there. And they landed there in huge vessels that must have looked like spaceships to the eye, and they looked physically different. Maybe there were such ideas or similar ideas there as well, but that wasn't the main thing. The main thing was that they engaged intention and subjectivity in the smallpox epidemic. A deity was born, Shopona, the deity, the god of smallpox, which then people then engaged the smallpox epidemic through. And throughout the history, this deity has then morphed and become a lot of different things. Now, that is engaging the intention and subjectivity in an animist way of something that happens in the world. When our ontology is fractured by modernity, we lose the capacity to read subjectivity and intention in stuff like the COVID. And that's why people start saying that was something that Bill Gates thought up in some laboratory and stuff like that. People need to be able to read that thing. And that makes us actually, it actually harms our capacity to relate to that stuff. When you read folklore traditional stories, you find, for instance, in Northern Europe that people have these little gnomes that protect typically a farmstead. Now, from an animist perspective, such a gnome is, in fact, the subjectivity that inhabits the way that a group of people, a family, for instance, relate to the agrarian produce that give them life. That's life-giving relation. That's also why it's a bad motherfucker. If you don't treat it right, if you don't give it its porridge, it will hit you back, kill all the cows, and make you insane. Now, the loss of relating with this subjectivity is bad for the farm. And I think that you can probably see that the loss of connection with the subjectivity, then the way that it, for instance, produces conspiracy theories, that it's like in a rather literal sense bad for the farm. It for instance, allows COVID to spread even more. There was a place in northern India where they personified COVID as a goddess. So this is one example, concrete example of how, like, narratives can go awry, and the animist aspect of narratives, it's almost as if it presses narratives into craziness. Animist mythologies, from an animist perspective, mythologies are stories that enable us to relate to something. The myth of Thor enables humans to relate to a specific aspect of reality, thunder, perhaps specific kinds of masculinity, and so on and so forth, right? And so you see that if animism is not taken into account, it actually becomes really dysfunctional and actually does really harmful things.
And you can say that there was a lot of imagination going into some of these conspiracy theories. I mean, Hillary Clinton in the pizza joint with I don't know what. So so that is where we are. That is our meaning making in the beginning of the 21st century. And I would like to conclude on this and ask you, do you have a couple of final words before we say goodbye for now? I've really appreciated all your inputs and comments. So Rune and then Robin and then goodbye for now. Rune, please.
Well, just that you can find my work on, if you look for Nordic Animism, and you can find me on TikTok. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And I don't have a university position, so I have to be a little bit blatant in my branding here. And yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me. And I hope it made sense. I didn't make too much of a fool of myself. And yeah.
I very much appreciate everything you said, and the freedom that comes from not having a university position allows you to create all fantastic events, and I can absolutely highly recommend that people go to the Nordic Animism and, for instance, your campus masquerade events. So thank you, Rune. Robin, a couple of final words from you.
No, a big thank you to both of you for having this wonderfully open conversation. Learned a lot. I think that we share an interest in, telling stories about stories, and that we see that people are again telling new stories that help them make sense of the here and now and position themselves in relation to the past and the future. And I want to ask everybody to keep experimenting with big enough stories that are progressive and get us out of this rut, and stay away from the conspiracy theories and be aware for the fascists.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you to both of you for joining me here at the Nordic Metamodern. We will explore both the Nordics and the Metamodern and tons of other stuff in our day and age, and hopefully heading towards a fruitful, meaningful future with tons of heritage that allow us to connect both to each other and to nature and to our shared past. So thank you for joining us.